Good morning and welcome to Cosmic Influence. My name is Walter Cruttenden and I'm here with co-host Jeff Pitino.
How are you?
And we're the guys that work at the Binary Research Institute here in California, and we investigate all sorts of unusual phenomena, particularly related to this concept of the Great Year, this rise and fall of civilizations that so many ancient cultures talk about. And I've heard some people, when they hear this concept about some of the anomalous artifacts that are found out of context in history, such as the Babylon Battery or the Antikythera device, some have said, well, heck, maybe that was put there by time travelers from the future. And we've sort of chuckled at that. But today we have a guest that can answer that question, perhaps, or give us some perspective from a more scientific point of view. And our guest today is Professor Ronald L. Mallett, and he's a professor at the University of Connecticut. And Jeff will give a little more background.
Well, yeah, Dr. Mallett's new book is Time Traveler, A Scientist's Personal Mission to Make Time Travel a Reality. And it's a dramatic and inspirational story of the work relating to his discovery of the basic equations for a working time machine based on Einstein's theory of general relativity that he believes can be used as a transport vehicle to the past.
Outstanding.
Which I think is really cool to kind of take the ideas out of science fiction and see if there's actually a way to implement it in reality.
That's great. And so, Ron, are you on the phone?
Yes, I am.
Hi. It's a pleasure having you on the show. And, man, this is a subject we're going to not even get to all the questions we have. So maybe you can just start us off by telling us a little bit more about your background and how you became interested in this esoteric subject to begin with.
Right, Walter. Well, the way I became interested was actually it was a personal tragedy in my life. My father was... For me, he was everything. He was a giant. He was a really friendly person, and he was a great father. And none of us realized how weak his heart was, and he died suddenly of a heart attack when he was only 33, and I was 10 years old.
Oh.
And it was something that really caused my world to collapse around me, and I really became very depressed afterwards. But I loved to read. That was one of the gifts that he left me. And about a year after he died, when I was 11, I came across H.G. Wells' classic science fiction story, The Time Machine. And I have to say that really turned me around. That became a life preserver for me. It became my holy grail. What I thought that I could do was to, if I could build a time machine, then I could go back into the past and see him again and maybe save his life. So that really became my goal and my inspiration to build a time machine. And I became obsessed with that. Thing is about a year after that, when I was about 12, I came across a popular level book called The Universe and Dr. Einstein that talked about this great genius Einstein, who said that time wasn't something that was fixed. Time could, in fact, be changed in different ways. So I became extremely excited because, to me, this meant that the possibility of a time machine could be real, because if this genius Einstein said that time could be changed, then if I could understand what he was saying, then that would lead me to a time machine. So Einstein became my second obsession. And that's how I really got started. I mean, it was...
Do you think that was part of your impetus then to take physics courses in school and go on to be a professor?
Yeah, well, it would be nice if the story read that linearly, but it didn't quite. I mean, I was obsessed with Einstein, but believe it or not, I hated my high school physics course. It sounds weird, but the thing is that it shows what good teaching, the difference between good teaching and bad teaching. I loved my math courses, and my math teacher was extremely inspirational, but my physics teacher was not. And so I originally thought that what I needed to do was to figure out how to use electronics, because my father was a TV repairman, I should have mentioned. And so my natural way of thinking that a time machine would be built is by somehow learning electronics. So So my original goal was to actually go into electrical engineering rather than physics, because I thought, well, that's natural that somehow you could use electronics. It wasn't until I got into the Air Force. We were very poor after my father died, and so college wasn't right in my future. So my idea after high school was to go into the service.
Okay, well, hold that thought, because we have so many questions on this subject, but we got to take a quick break. You're listening to Cosmic Influence. You mentioned you were interested in Einstein and that his theory of general relativity makes room for some possibilities with time. Can you give us just a summary of what that means?
Okay. Well, I probably should mention that Einstein developed two theories. One was the special theory of relativity, which he developed in 1905, and that theory has to do with objects traveling at high rates of speed. And his second theory, the general theory of relativity, which he developed 10 years later, has to do with gravity. Both theories have to do with time. That is to say, in Einstein's special theory of relativity, and this was the thing that first got my attention, was the fact that Einstein said that the faster a clock moves, the more time will slow down on that clock. And that was really the key to the notion of time travel into the future, that if you could move an object fast enough, a clock, and you have to remember that our heart rate, metabolism, are clocks, then time would slow down for us, and we could travel into the future. We would only age very slowly compared to everyone else, and so we would arrive in the future younger
and
than everyone else.
For our listeners, that's been proven, right, with satellites and clocks?
That's right. In fact, the most dramatic experiment that was done in the 1970s, which a lot of people aren't aware of, was using ordinary passenger jet, in which they put one atomic clock was put on a passenger jet, and the other one was kept stationary at the Naval Observatory. When they flew the atomic clock around the world on a passenger jet and brought it back, when they compared the time on the passenger jet with the clock that was stationary, they found that the clock on the passenger jet had run slower than the clock that had been stationary at the Naval Observatory. So this actually demonstrates what Einstein said, that time for a moving clock slows down. That means that everyone on board that plane was younger by fractions of a second. So that jet actually had traveled fractions of a second into the future. So time travel into the future is already demonstrated. Now, I was interested in time travel into the past, and it turns out that you can't use Einstein's special theory of relativity to do that, because you can't get an object to go fast enough to go into the past. However, in his general theory of relativity, it turns out that you can use gravity to change time. And that was the important key for me. What Einstein said in his general theory of relativity was that the stronger gravity is, the more time will slow down on a clock. That is to say that, for example, gravity here at the surface of the Earth is stronger than gravity at the top of a mountain. That means that a clock here at the surface of the Earth would run slower than the clock on top of a mountain where gravity is weaker. Now, you might say, has this been demonstrated? As a matter of fact, it has, in a very dramatic and everyday way, because there are clocks on the GPS satellites, and it turns out that we have found that these clocks are actually running at a different rate because they are, gravity is much weaker where they are than clocks here at the surface of the Earth. That is to say, clocks here at the surface of the Earth are actually running slower than the clocks in the GPS satellites. And the reason why this is important is because if this was not taken into account by engineers, in other words, by using computer signals to calibrate those clocks and bring them back in sync, we would not be able to find our position here on the surface of the Earth. So the very fact that time, gravity affects time, has a practical consequence for GPS satellites. So we know that gravity can change time.
Okay.
And my idea was to use not the gravity of the Earth, okay, of matter. We know that gravity can be produced by matter. What most people don't realize, and this is only true within Einstein's theory, is that light can create gravity. Not only matter, but light itself can create gravity. So you can see how my reasoning went. If light can create gravity and gravity can change time, then I could use light to change time. So that's the core of my idea, is to use the gravitational field that's created by light, laser light in particular, change time. And this would allow me to go into the future or into the past. And in particular, I found that there's a special way of using laser beams that will allow you to go into the past. In particular, if you use what's known as a circulating light beam, and you can create a circulating light beam in a number of different ways. That just simply means you get a laser beam going around in a loop. Okay, mm-hmm. And once you produce a laser beam going around in a loop, it does something very strange and interesting to both space and time. And there's actually a way to visualize what it does to space and time. It's important to understand that in Einstein's general theory of relativity, space acts as though it were substance. And so this is the way to visualize it, how a circulating light beam can affect space
Please.
And then time. Imagine that you have a cup of coffee sitting in front of you. And imagine that the coffee in the cup represents empty space. And imagine that you have a spoon. That spoon represents the circulating light beam. Now, what happens when you take the spoon and stir the coffee? The coffee starts swirling around, right?
Right.
Well, that's what the circulating light beam does to empty space. The circulating light beam, as it circulates, will stir empty space just the way the spoon stirred the coffee in the cup. Now, in the case of the coffee, you could see the effect of the coffee by, let's say, taking you take just a coffee bean and throw it into the cup. Well, you can see what's going to happen. As I stir the coffee bean will move around
right.
in the coffee, okay? Now, the thing that's in space, you might say, well, if it's empty space, how am I going to see, you know, space being swirled around? Well, the thing that plays the role of the coffee bean would be a subatomic particle that's called a neutron. A neutron is a part of every atom. Now, if we take a neutron and we put it into the empty space, then if I take the circulating light beam and stir the empty space, the space will actually take the neutron and twist it around. Just like the coffee bean was being dragged around by the coffee, the space will actually drag the neutron around. So even though you couldn't see the space directly being twisted around
you
by the circulating
the
light beam, you could see the neutron. So that's a very precise experiment, and that was predicted by my theory. I developed the theory based on Einstein's equations, and I was able to show that a circulating light beam causes a twisting of this empty space that would show up as a neutron being dragged around.
Okay, so now, that experiment has been conducted then, huh?
Well, the experiment has, because I did the theory. I mean, I developed the theory to show that this would happen. This was a new prediction. The experiment has to be done yet. I'm a theoretical physicist. I should mention that Einstein was a theoretical physicist, not an experimental physicist. His equation, for example, E=mc². He developed that equation, but it would require experimental physicists and engineers to show that the equation actually led to mass being converted into energy.
Sure.
I've done the same thing. I've developed the basic equations showing that circulating light will twist empty space. And I have an experimental colleague who's an expert in lasers, and he's working with me to develop the experiment to test my theory. Now, the thing is that in Einstein's theory, what's important to realize is that space and time are linked to each other. According to Einstein's theory, whatever you do to space also happens to time. So what this means is that as you're circulating space with this light beam, you will actually eventually cause time to become twisted into a loop. Now, what this means is that imagine that you have a piece of paper in front of you and you draw a straight line on it. And you call that line a timeline. That is to say that line that you draw on the strip of paper, at the bottom of the line, put the past.
Mm-hmm.
And at the middle of the line, put the present, today. And at the top of the line, put tomorrow, the future. So we have this straight line of time, and all of us, even though we're conscious of it, all of us flow along this timeline from the past to the present to the future. Our consciousness moves along that. Now, the thing is that as space is getting twisted, what will eventually happen is that time, since space and time are linked, will get twisted into a loop. So if you take that straight piece of paper and make a loop out of it, that is to say connect the top of the strip of the paper to the bottom, you can begin to see what's going to happen. As you start on the strip of paper from the past yesterday and move along the strip of paper to the present, and then continue along the strip of paper to the future. But remember, you've taken that piece of paper and attached the top to the bottom, so that means that the future you've attached to the past. So as you're moving along that strip of paper, you're going from the past to the present to the future, and from the future back into the past. So by using a circulating light beam, you can cause empty space to become twisted, and then you can eventually cause time to be twisted in a loop, and along that loop in time, you could travel back into the past. And this, the equations that I develop, as I said, are based on Einstein's general theory of relativity. So it is possible to use those equations to develop a machine that would allow you to travel into the past or into the future. You don't even have to twist the time into a loop to travel into the future. Just the light beam itself will do that. But you will have to cause the twisting of space in order to get the loop in time. So that's the basis of it, is that you twist space, then you twist time into a loop, and then along the loop in time, you can travel back into the past.
Yeah, so theoretically, it's possible. There's about a zillion tricky questions, though, and implications to time travel.
Oh, yes.
And I'm sure you've heard most of those. So let's start dealing with them.
Okay.
I guess maybe the big one first. Can you speak to the grandfather's paradox?
Oh, yeah. That's the classic, and you're quite correct. That's one of the most important. In fact, all of the other paradoxes can be lumped into that one. And the essence of that paradox is the fact that suppose that you arrive in the past and you see your grandfather and you prevent him from meeting your grandmother. I like to use that more benign way of doing it. And if you prevent them from meeting each other, then your grandparents don't have your parents. And if they don't have your parents don't have you. And if they don't have you, then what happened to you? How were you able to go back and cause this mischief?
You shouldn't be there.
That's the grandfather paradox, that you could do something that could lead to this what seems like an impossibility. And the thing is that physics, in fact, leads to a way out of that, because the other important pillar of physics, besides relativity, which I've been talking about, is quantum physics. Quantum physics is the other pillar of relativity. I mean, that's in addition to relativity. And quantum physics is extremely important to us. Without quantum physics, we wouldn't have our personal computers, our cell phones. All of these things are aspects that come out of quantum physics. Quantum physics, you might say, if you wanted to give a quick definition, relativity deals with space and time. Quantum physics deals with matter and energy. Now, what quantum physics says is that you cannot predict exactly what's going to happen in the future. Even if you have knowledge of what's happening at the moment, you can only predict probably what's going to happen in the future. And in quantum physics, there was a man named Hugh Everett, who was PhD graduate student of the legendary John Wheeler of black hole fame. And Everett applied quantum theory to look at the universe as a whole. And when he did that, what he came up with is the fact that quantum theory predicts that our universe may not be alone. That is to say, we may be only one of many parallel universes. And this whole notion of parallel universes, which comes directly from quantum physics, leads to the possibility of a way out of the paradox in the following way. According to...
Well, hold on for that following way until we come back from the break. You're listening to Cosmic Influence. We're talking with Ron Mallett, PhD and theoretical physicist and professor of physics at University of Connecticut, about time. And Ron, you are just in the midst of your explanation regarding the quantum probability here.
Right. Well, the thing is that according to Everett's many-world or parallel universe theory, what can happen, and this was applied to the notion of how it could affect time travel, this was done by David Deutsch at Oxford University. What he found was the fact that if you go back into the past, you arrive in the past of a parallel universe. This universe looks almost exactly like our universe. In fact, it has to be nearly exactly because it has to have a time machine like the one that you had in the original universe. But once you get back into the past, you're in the past of this parallel universe. In that parallel universe, you can do anything that you want. You can, in fact, prevent your grandparents from meeting. And you just find yourself in a weird world in which you were never born into that world, but you are in that world. However, you remember that you came into a parallel universe. The original universe that you came from is unaffected. So that universe does lead to your grandparents meeting and the sequence leading to you. Consequently, the resolution of the paradox is the fact that when you travel back into the past, you arrive in the past of a parallel universe, and you can never get back to your original universe. But in that new universe, you can do anything you want, and it doesn't lead to any paradox. I go into this a little bit more detail in my book, Time Traveler, this notion of the paradox, as well as other possibilities. But that's how it is resolved, by using the notion of parallel universes.
So in essence, if your name's Marty McFly, you don't have to worry about slowly disappearing if you don't get your parents to re-meet after you've stopped them.
Exactly. That's it. You wouldn't have to if this is so. And the thing is that, as I said, it's totally consistent with quantum theory. However, the only way that we're really going to know whether this plays out in that way is by doing the experiment, is by actually going back into the past. Another resolution that people think about going back into the past is that when you go back into the past, you do whatever it is that you do in the past is determined. That is to say that it is already something that is part of our present. So you really don't change the past. You actually become part of the past, and you do things that lead to what we already know are going to happen. That's another alternative, and that means that there is no free will, that everything really is determined, even if you go back into the past to determine that or try to change things.
That has all sorts of philosophical implications.
Oh, yes. Oh, definitely. In fact, and more than that, but however, even the whole process of time travel itself has limitations, which people aren't aware of because they're used to the way in which we see time travel in movies. That mm-hmm. is to say that we're used to the notion that you could go back to any distant time. One of my favorite stories is Ray Bradbury's A Sound of Thunder, where the time travelers go back into the distant past mm-hmm. and change something at the time of the dinosaurs. However, there's a problem to that. And in fact, it answers a question that people like Stephen Hawking and others had originally raised, but essentially have backed off. You know, if time travel into the past is possible, then how come we're not inundated with time travelers?
Right.
I mean, that seems like, you know,
logical
question. The answer to that is the fact that you can't go back earlier than the time that the time machine was turned on. And this is something that's almost always forgotten. That is to say that it is the time machine that creates the condition for time for going back into the past. For example, let's suppose we're talking about my particular theory. And I'm going to just sketch this a little bit, as I said, very briefly. I do go into it in more detail in my book, Time Traveler. But the thing is that you turn on the device today. You create these circulating loops of time starting today. You leave the device on, let's say, for, 10 years. Someone 10 years from now could travel back 7 years, 5 years. Okay, they could travel back any length of time, all the way back up to the time that you turned the device on. But they can't go back earlier than that because it's the device that created the condition. And if you think about it, it makes sense. You don't get something from your radio before you turn it on. So you can't have something materialize into nothing. It has to materialize back at the time the machine was turned on.
Now, what if there was a machine that, say, somebody else had built that had been around 10 years earlier.
Right. Well, you actually go into an aspect that that's the thing. If they had the technology to do it, but here it's unlikely because of the fact that we only have developed technology here on the Earth very recently. For instance, lasers, for example. But think about this in terms of other civilizations on other worlds. Now, one of the things that I'm a believer in is that the universe is teeming with life. We know since the 1990s about extrasolar planets. That is to say that these are planets that are orbiting other suns.
Right. We've now discovered more than 200 of them.
Exactly. And this has very important consequences because this is just in our local neighborhood of our galaxy. Okay, and it's very, very likely that eventually we're going to find Earth-like planets that have life conditions and life on them. And some of these planets will be more advanced than us, and some will be less advanced than us. On those that are more advanced than us, they may have, in fact, developed time travel, let's say 10,000 years ago. Now, if they turned on their machines 10,000 years ago, this means that if we encounter these civilizations, their machine will have the same limitation, but if we encounter these civilizations, we could use their machine to go back into our distant past. So that means we could ultimately be able to see ancient Rome and ancient Egypt if we were once we encounter these civilizations and if they have developed time travel millennia before we have.
Well, this is how tricky this whole subject is, and of course it has to be true that you must have these civilizations with these time machines, because if you have parallel universes, then you have the concept of infinity, and therefore they have to be out there if there's infinite possibilities. But we don't have infinite time on this show, so we're going to take a quick break here, and we're talking with Professor Ronald L. Mallett, who's about the concept of time. Welcome back to Cosmic Influence. On this concept that you can only go back to the period in which time machines were first turned on, you should be aware of this old myth in folklore, and I don't know if there's anything to it, but we're exploring this whole idea that civilization does have this rise and fall, and it's based on myth and folklore and some linguistic studies and anomalous artifacts and this sort of thing. And anyway, this African myth talks about a man entering a stone henge. And the oldest one known to man happens to be in Africa nowadays. It's in an area called Nabta Playa, and it's almost 10,000 years old. But we're all familiar with Stonehenge, but there's thousands of them that have been discovered around the world. And the myth is that man goes in. When he comes out, his friend asks him, where were you? You disappeared. And he said, oh, I didn't go anywhere. I just went to a different time. And, you think about these heavy stone things that are difficult to move. If you are jumping around in time, you do need a stable place to land, so to speak. At least that's my concept of it. And I wonder if you have any thoughts on that idea. If time travel is possible in the future, then might it have been possible in the past?
Well, the thing is that this is a big if we were able to find out, and eventually we may, from archaeological studies, civilizations that had sophisticated technology that we didn't realize. I mean, we're talking about millennia out there, of course, and it's, who knows what we've lost. I mean, all one has to think about is the fire at the library in Alexandria, yeah. Who knows what knowledge we have lost and what technology really was out there. But and so that if there had been ancient civilizations with sophisticated enough technology to have developed time travel, the thing is that their devices would have to be on and still on, you see, because, and that's an important thing, because it could happen that if they had them, we could use it. But you have to remember that the device has to be on and stable enough to stay on for all those millennia up to now. It cannot have been interrupted at any point because these time loops, and no matter how they're created, these time loops have to be continuously created. It's like the circulating light beam. It's like you have to continually keep stirring that cup of coffee. You cannot stop because when you stop, the eddy stops and there's a disrupt. So the thing is that if we did find some ancient civilization, it's possible. But as I said, we haven't found anything.
Yeah, but your concept then is to potentially be able to do it with laser lights and some circulating pattern, and therefore it's fairly modern concepts of power. How much power are you talking about?
Well, the thing is that for time travel into the future, it's actually not that much. It's actually a modest amount of power. For time travel into the past, we're talking about huge amount of power. I mean, we're talking about an enormous amount of power that right now we could. That's why, in fact, I should mention, and I didn't emphasize this at the beginning of our conversation, but my work, my research, is not to send human beings back into the past. That would require energy that seems almost to us right now to be unimaginable from sources. What we're focusing on is trying to send subatomic particles and information back in time. And to do that, it turns out that the size of the device is small enough that the power requirements, even though huge, are not as great. Just to give you a specific example, the size of the actual device that we're using, that we'll be using small, high-powered lasers. These are actually diode lasers to twist space initially. And the size of the device will be the width of a human hair.
Interesting.
Okay. And so with that, what we're trying to show is that we can affect time for subatomic particles, and that we're going to be able to send information into the future or into the past, as well as subatomic particles we could send into the future or into the past. And as I said, the energy requirements are still huge. However, it turns out that laser technology seems to be keeping pace with the sort of thing that we're going to be needing. Not sure whether you're familiar with the recent research that's been done on antimatter molecules. These have just been discovered within the past couple of months. This was just actually the latter part of last year. It was described in Nature that these antimatter molecules could potentially lead to lasers that are as different from the lasers today as chemical reactions are from nuclear reactions.
Interesting.
Oh, yeah. This is real. This is, as I said, this is so brand new discovery. These antimatter molecules. It's called dipositronium, and it was discovered, in fact, out there, it was the University of California it was discovered. In any case, so the power requirements, while large, will be able to be met. But as I said, initially, we're going to try to show that we can just twist space and send subatomic particles and information into the future. And that has modest power requirements.
As far as sending a subatomic particle back into the past, how do you measure to see if that's actually taken place?
Very good question. The way in which we're going to do it is one of those nice kind of experiments that scientists and engineers like. It's the following way. We know that in nature there are subatomic particles that exist that only live for a very short period of time, unlike the electron, which lives forever. These particles, some of them are called pions, others are called muons. These particles live for only a millionth of a second and disintegrate. But each one of these type of particles has only a very specific lifetime. For example, these pions that live for a millionth of a second and completely disintegrate. Now, all of them live exactly the same amount of time. That's the important thing, so that you know you have a calibration here. Now, suppose that you've created this loop in time, in some region. If you send a beam of these short-lived particles into that laser mix, then have a detector on the other side. If the loop in time has been created, then what you would find is that the particles arriving at the detector will have a different lifetime. Their lifetimes will be different as a result of having encountered that time loop. So by having changed the lifetime of these particles, you would have a clear-cut signature that you have changed, that you have affected their life, and by sending them back into the past or
Got
into
it.
The future,
Got it.
You see? Okay. So it's a very, that's one of those really clean, nice type of, that's what we're going to be doing.
Okay, hold on one moment. We'll be right back with Cosmic Influence.
Welcome back to The Cosmic Influence. I'm Jeff Pitino with our host, Walter Cruttenden, and our guest today is Dr. Ronald L. Mallett. He's a theoretical physicist and professor of physics at the University of Connecticut, and he has a new book out called Time Traveler, A Scientist's Personal Mission to Make Time Travel a Reality. It's available both in bookstores and on Amazon.com. And Dr. Mallett, you've got a website as well that's www.physics.ucon, that's UConn.edu, and if they click on faculty, they'll be able to find more information about you as well.
That's right. Thank you.
So I have a question about, as far as time travel goes, is there, in the distant future at some point when people are ever able to travel into the past, is there some, like, spatial relativity, I guess, that would be going on? Like, say you turned on the time machine.
Right.
And let it go for 10 years and then decide to travel 10 years back into the past. Would it send you 10 years back into the past in space where the Earth happens to be?
In its orbit around the sun and the galaxy.
You'd basically materialize into empty space because nothing's arrived there yet.
Right, right. That's an excellent question, Jeff. And the thing is that the way to visualize what's happening and how this works is by imagining a very simple child's toy. It's called a slinky. And imagine, for example, that you turn the circulating light on, mm-hmm. and the slinky represents the loops in time. Now, if you hold the base of the slinky where the Earth is now, say, mm-hmm. okay, and imagine that as the Earth is moving, okay, the circulating light beam is moving with the Earth. So that means that the time loops are adjusting. That is to say, imagine that you're holding the top of the slinky and moving to where the Earth as it's moving. You can see that all of the time loops, it's like creating a helix. Uh-huh. All of the time loops are connected to the loops below them, okay?
Okay.
So that wherever the Earth is like in 10 years, the top of the slinky is where that is. So what you're doing in 10 years is you're spiraling back along space and time. You're spiraling along those loops of the slinky, and you're getting back along the loop all the way back to the base of the slinky, which is where the Earth is now.
Okay. So essentially you'd be following the path that the machine took as it
exactly.
traveled through time. Okay. Is it possible that this might already be this sort of time loop that you're discussing as far as experimentally creating with lasers might already be happening in the natural universe, say around a black hole where light could potentially be trapped in a gravitational loop?
Absolutely. I mean, the thing is that, and that's, yes, because of the fact that a black hole, light can go into orbit around a black hole. And since light can go into an orbit around a black hole, light normally can't do that around mm-hmm. other objects, but it can around a black hole. That means that once light is going into orbit around the black hole, that's creating a circulating light beam. And that means then that you would actually have a natural time machine, because once the circulating light beam is there, as time evolves, then that circulating light beam is creating time loops that are associated with that region around the black hole. So it is very possible that nature has created its own natural. Well, we haven't seen that yet, but it's definitely theoretically possible.
Does the device have to be based on circulating visible light?
No, it doesn't have to be based on circulating visible. It could be just any circulating light, but it's just the more intense the light is, the more likely you're going to get the twisting of space and the loops in time, because the effect depends on the intensity. It actually depends on the intensity and the size of the loop as well. but it depends on the intensity of the beam. So the brighter, you might say, the better.
But can it be anything within the electromagnetic spectrum there then?
Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, it could be, yeah,
it could be X-rays,
gamma rays. I mean, and of course, gamma rays are much more energetic, right? So, yes, it could be anything in the light spectrum. When I say light, and it could be visible light. It could be any frequency.
Okay. Now, realistically, how far out are we before something like this can be scaled up, assuming the early experiments work out on a micro level?
Yeah, well, that is uncertain. I mean, we haven't even tried to estimate that. However, I have my own private prediction about how fast it would happen, because I like to think of the work that I'm doing is analogous to where the Wright brothers were. You remember how that happened? Like in 1903, you had the Wright brothers with this rickety device going a few hundred yards down a beach, and by the middle of the century, we had intercontinental jet travel. So that is the same acceleration. But if you had asked the Wright brothers at the time, give me an estimate when you think we're going to have intercontinental jet travel, right?
They wouldn't know what you're talking about.
Exactly. They wouldn't even know what you're talking about, let alone giving you an estimate.
Right.
So the thing is that once we're able to show the concept can happen, even for information and subatomic particles, I believe personally that there will be such an acceleration in technology that we will probably be able to do it within a century.
Everything does seem to be happening on a faster scale nowadays.
Yes, it will continue that way and increase.
So let's say we can do it, then is it dangerous?
Yeah, the question is, should we do it?
Right. Well, the thing is that it's one of those things that you have to weigh, and it's one of those things that as people and as responsible people of the world, it has to be a technology that's controlled. We know the benefits of traveling, air travel, but we also know all we have to do is just think about 9/11 to know the consequences, the disastrous consequences of mm-hmm. air travel as well. So mm-hmm. we have to regulate it. It's not going to be a technology that's just simply going to be allowed to be used. It's going to have to be regulated like any other technology. But it will happen, whether we develop it or not. It will happen because it's one of these things that there's this human impulse to do what, you know, we are able to do. We're going to try to achieve it. And the thing is that the positive benefit of it, and this is one of those things that I try to mention in the book, is the benefits that are associated, is that I actually did a provisional patent in connection with this, is it could be used as an early warning device. That is to say, imagine if we had a tool that allowed us to be able to warn ourselves in the present of future catastrophes.
The possibilities are endless, but unfortunately, we're out of time. So thank you for being on the show. You're listening to Cosmic Influence. We'll be right back.
And welcome back to Cosmic Influence. That was a fascinating show, and it just flew by. We were thrilled to have Dr. Ronald L. Mallett from the University of Connecticut on the show with us today. And once again, his book is Time Traveler, A Scientist's Personal Mission to Make Time Travel a Reality, and it's available on Amazon.com.
And speaking of good books available on Amazon, be sure to check out Lost Star of Myth and Time. It's the one that Jeff and I worked on, and it covers many of these subjects that we talk about on our show, Cosmic Influence. Also, check out our new website on the CPAC conference. It's
www.cpaconline.com, and it's CPAKonline.com.
In the meantime, bring on the higher ages.